Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
So here's the creek.
This is the creek?
This is the creek.
Okay, yep. That's the creek. And this is the sound of me sticking my microphone through a stormwater sewer in search of a buried river. Believe me, I got lots of looks. I was a bit of a spectacle standing near a busy intersection in East Vancouver. Jayla, I have you to blame for putting me in that strange position.
Yeah, sorry, not sorry for roping you into this hunt.
And this is Jayla Bernstein, by the way. She's a reporter with CBC News Labs in Montreal. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And it's great to have you here. I'm Laura Lynch. You're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. And together, Jayla and I have been on an adventure. We've been tracking down lost rivers in Canada's largest cities. And before we get into what we found, tell us, what is a lost river?
So a lot of Canadian cities like Montreal, where I live, are built along water, but they're also actually built over top of brooks and creeks and rivers. And after European settlers arrived, we ended up polluting a lot of these waterways. And our solution was basically to stick them in sewer pipes or brick over them.
Okay, so now there is this idea to bring back these lost waterways, back to the surface, if you will. And it's got this really evocative label called daylighting.
Yeah. And of course, you know that we're in the middle of two environmental crises right now, climate change and biodiversity loss. And this idea of daylighting, reviving these lost rivers, can help with both of those.
All right. Let's get the adventure underway. Jayla, let's start with you.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good.
On a sunny day last fall, Craig Hetherington meets me in Montreal's southwest, near the Lachine Canal. We're going on a hunt for a buried river, one that's now flowing through the sewers. A friend had told me about these lost rivers, and I became obsessed, not just with learning more about them, but with finding one for myself. Is this the right way to go, or should
we
go?
Yeah, I mean, this is the way to go. It's going to get a bit hairy under there, but
okay, whatever you think's easiest. Craig Hetherington is an anthropologist, and he teaches at Concordia University. He and a group of his students had mapped the path of one of Montreal's lost rivers. It's called the Saint-Pierre.
So most of, you know, what we think of as the Saint-Pierre now is all in pipes, is all in concrete pipes that were built at some point.
I was surprised to learn just how many rivers had been rerouted into our sewers. About 82% of Montreal's original waterways are lost.
Okay, it is around here somewhere.
Oh, you can smell it.
Yeah, you can definitely smell it.
We're in like this little city park off of the Lachine Canal. We're walking into the woods to find a sewer grate.
Yeah, there it is. It always surprises me quite how much water there is down there. It's quite, it is quite a flow.
There's such a force to the rushing current. It's the remnants of the St. Pierre River mixed in with wastewater and hidden away in the sewers. It's a lot more water than I expect.
This is the kind of hidden gem where you go, oh, there really was a river here, and there really is something like a river underground still that you can sort of commune with in one way or another.
We peer through the bars of a large sewer grate 20 feet down to the surging water. I can just imagine what it was like when there was a full-blown river here.
And we certainly know that there were people using the Saint-Pierre to get inland on the island on canoes.
Craig thinks the river used to be about 15 kilometers long, flowing down the slopes of Mount Royal all the way to the St. Lawrence.
So you can imagine people coming up and camping along here and fishing in this part of the waterway at the time.
He says parts of it were more like a shallow creek, but in the spring, it was probably deeper and wider. Indigenous peoples all across Canada used waterways for food, water, and transportation.
Like, these creeks are like, they're the pathways that these people got up north and south.
Ethan Keyes tends to an Anishinaabe garden near where Lost Creek used to flow through Toronto.
This area was like, it's like the meeting place. So all of these creeks were used to get down here to meet and to trade. Because yeah, there's so much history that we've kind of paved over.
Later, Europeans used them for fishing, irrigating farms, or powering mills. But as cities expanded and populations grew, the brooks, streams, and creeks were all littered with garbage and waste. They weren't just smelly, they were actual health hazards. And in the 19th and 20th centuries, outbreaks of diseases like cholera and typhoid sealed the river's fates. Engineers started channeling them into sewers, sending them into the darkness. But the rivers are still down there, and daylighting them could actually help us deal with climate change. The waterways and their riverbanks would help absorb carbon dioxide, provide cooling in a heat wave, and could soak up and carry off heavy rains.
This feeling of standing over the river now, I don't know, it makes me feel like the city has more layers than I ever imagined before. It's like the city feels like this wonderful alive space that has all these living things in it that supports us and so many other things. On the other hand, it makes it feel like how much work, ingenuity, but also destruction went into creating the city as we know it today.
The St. Pierre River did survive in part. A little 200-meter stretch in the west end of the city kept flowing until it was sent into a pipe just a couple years ago. Some local activists do still hold out hope that the St. Pierre could one day be revived. But the official line from the city of Montreal is that restoring the St. Pierre is just too costly and too complex. That's because most of the island's sewer system is combined, stormwater mixed in with wastewater. In other words, freeing a river from the pipes would mean separating it from raw sewage, which would be a big job. So, with the lost rivers of Montreal pretty much out of reach to me, I'm off in search of a city where there is actual momentum to revive the rivers under our feet.
Here it is. We're at it.
Helen, who are you?
Well, I'm Helen Mills. I have been part of and founder of Lost Rivers since 1994. And before that, I was obsessed with the Lost Rivers for about 10 years.
Helen Mills reads Toronto's landscape like a book, searching for clues of lost rivers. She introduces people to a hidden part of the city, mapping buried waterways and leading guided tours.
I think that I made Toronto home by learning the land, by walking in the woods, and by learning the lost rivers.
I've traveled to meet her because, unlike Montreal, Toronto is exploring the possibility of restoring its buried waterways.
And then there's a gentle flow down that way.
Helen is the heart of that movement, and she dreams of a city where the rivers are unearthed and restored. They call it daylighting.
Yeah. So right now we're standing more or less on a runway that's been decommissioned.
Helen agreed to take me along the path of a lost waterway called Mud Creek. That's how we ended up standing on the shoulder of the Allen Expressway in the city's northwest. She peers through a chain link fence and points to a line of trees on an old airstrip. She says that's where Mud Creek used to flow.
Yeah, so we're at the headwaters in the midst of this maze of transportation networks. So it's quite the no person's land.
If you didn't know what you were looking for, you'd have no idea that Mud Creek started here. There's just these little traces that because you're plugged into this, you can tell, oh, maybe that's the remnants, right?
Yeah. It's all about looking at the old maps and then going into the landscape and trying to find the clues.
Mud Creek used to snake through the city for 11 kilometers before joining up with the larger Don River. Now, it's mostly erased. But Helen keeps its memory alive.
If you can imagine this as a forest, and then a farm, it was farmland for a very long time. And long before it was colonized, for about 11,000 years or so, people have been here doing various different things at different times.
When you look at how it is today, what do you feel?
I'm not really into that thing about nature good, city bad. I think it is. This is what it is. The dream is that dreamy forest we remember, that we can use that as a kind of baseline. And what can we do now to make the city work more the way that forest did?
I love that. Next stop?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Helen navigates our drive as we trace the path of Mud Creek north to south.
And then we're turning right here.
We turn into a residential area in North York where we discover a tiny hidden wetland sandwiched between a school, a dumpster, and the nearby 401.
Those are cattails. And again, goldenrod and New England aster and some milkweed. Wow.
Our final stop of the day is the Evergreen Brickworks. This is what we've been waiting for. Today's gotten increasingly green. We started out near all this concrete and pavement and highways.
Serious concrete wasteland.
And now we're almost in a forest. It's the former site of the Don Valley Brickworks, which supplied the literal building blocks for a lot of Toronto. Here, Mud Creek was channeled through the factory to forge bricks. After the plant closed, work began in the 90s to restore the land and the watershed.
We're definitely in a ideal case for urban greening.
A small section of the creek was daylit. Other parts that were already above ground and neglected were restored. Wetlands were added to slow down and filter the water where the creek joins up with the Don River. Today, a 2-kilometer stretch of Mud Creek is alive.
I think the city of Toronto is doing really an amazing job.
Luna Kerfon joins us for the final leg of Mud Creek's journey. She teaches urban planning at the University of Waterloo. Luna's originally from Jordan, and she's traveled the world studying daylighting success stories.
I grew up in one of the world's poorest countries in water. I grew up in a country where tap water runs only once a week. That's part of a daily existence. And I'm worried that we take our water way too much for granted in Canada. And I think we need to treat it more carefully.
She's seen the Cheonggyecheong River flowing through downtown Seoul, South Korea. She's seen a network of urban brooks daylit in Zurich, Switzerland. Luna says Canada still lags behind.
We definitely don't rank up there among the countries that are doing it.
But she and Helen both agree the brickworks is a sign of what's possible.
That's Mud Creek.
It's Mud Creek.
Yeah, that's the base flow from Mud Creek, to be exact.
The lost waterway we've chased all day is in front of us. It tumbles over a small waterfall and then flows into a series of ponds.
It feels like an urban oasis. It's like calm in the middle of the city, reconnecting with nature. I just love it. There's this beautiful pond with the ducks. There are these paths that meander uphill with gorgeous views. So beautiful.
We head upstream past a young man fishing. He tells us he's caught bass, sunfish, even goldfish here. Luna is happy to see the small piece of Mud Creek resurrected. But she wishes it was never buried in the first place. She says urban planners just didn't appreciate what they'd be losing.
I do think we did a huge mistake, undervaluing that these small brooks and creeks are part of a much bigger system. These brooks and streams provide food for us and fish and help with urban agriculture and so on, but they also help regulate water from rainwater runoff. They help regulate temperature, clean the air. So all of these are benefits that we lose when we lose these ecosystems. I would like to send the message that it doesn't have to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But also, I'll take a step back and say, if Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal want that status of being cities that are progressive, that are transformative, then sometimes we do need to invest in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in important infrastructure if we want to keep labeling our cities as world-class, as highly competitive. Then we do need to make bold decisions.
But if money is an obstacle, Luna points to Zurich. The Swiss city daylighted more than 20 kilometers of its urban brooks. The project cost about $44 million Canadian to complete, but the daylit streams save the city millions every year in water treatment costs. So much so that the project has already paid for itself. Other cities in the US, in Denmark, and in New Zealand, they've also joined the daylighting movement. And Helen wishes that Toronto would do the same.
It's good to be unrealistic, because when we started, daylighting was people's eyes crossed and glazed and they looked the other way. It's like, what are you talking about? And now it's common practice. Everyone's doing it. So yeah, you know, dream on.
I wanted to hear what the City of Toronto had to say about Helen and Luna's vision for the city. A recent motion from council suggests it is interested in restoring more urban rivers, or at least thinking about it. But the city hasn't made any promises. Not yet. A report looking into the possibilities is expected later this year. Jeff Thompson works for the City of Toronto as an environmental planner, and he's a big believer in daylighting, as long as it makes technical and financial sense.
I think that it brings us back to this relationship between the city and nature. We're facing a climate emergency right now, and the city is warming, and watercourses can provide a component of relief from the urban heat island effect. And if we don't explore opportunities to act on that, then we'll be faced with future consequences.
Jeff and I met at Woburn Park in North York. It's one of the spots along Mud Creek's unseen path where the waterway runs under the grass through pipes. Helen thinks it could be the perfect spot to bring the creek back to the surface. So I put her idea to Jeff. Why not here? Why not in this park?
Well, I think this is a perfect example of an area that the city could look at.
The city seems to be taking a cue from grassroots dreamers like Helen. When Jeff and I finish chatting, he says he wants to show me something nearby. It's called Burke Brook, and it's still flowing above ground along a forested walking trail in the city.
It shows you, you know, what an exposed watercourse can do in the middle of a city.
It's really nice here. I mean, there's this little patch of wilderness. It's definitely not fully restored yet, and this spot could use some TLC. There's an old telephone, a water bottle, and pieces of discarded clothing littering the water. But you can see the creek. There are birds singing nearby, people are enjoying themselves. For Jeff, this is a taste of how flowing water can improve an urban space.
It's definitely tranquil. It's definitely cooler than it would be if we were walking down the main street. And it's peaceful and quiet.
I notice an older couple standing quietly next to the water. It's Rosh Hashanah, and they seem to be praying. I go over to talk to them, and the gentleman turns out to be a rabbi.
The water is the source of life, but in the same time, it's symbolic that whatever we want to achieve in life, if we don't give ourselves in and cross all the stumbling blocks, nothing will happen. And that's exactly why we are here.
So it's important for you on the high holiday to be near running water like this.
Yes, definitely so. That's why we came and connect again with nature. See, modern life detaches person from nature. Don't go away from nature. Nature is the source of everything, as the land is the source. And that's why we are here today.
And we've been listening to Jayla Bernstein's Hunt for Lost Rivers in Toronto and Montreal. And Jayla, that rabbi was so poetic about the importance of nature and water in our lives.
Yeah, and he really emphasized the importance of having water close to where we live.
And Luna Kirfan and Helen Mills make it sound like restoring urban rivers is really within reach.
I think they really hope so. And though in Toronto, it's still kind of at the theoretical stage, in Vancouver, where you are, daylighting seems to be more of a reality.
It is. And that's why I'm taking over the hunt for lost waterways on the West Coast. And do you know just how easy it is to find them here?
Tell me.
It was this easy. I found one by accident here on a beach where I sometimes take my dog to play. This time, I noticed a sign. It's from the City of Vancouver, and it's about plans to daylight Canyon Creek, allowing it to flow above ground, cutting across the beach to the sea. And it's happening this year right in front of thousands who visit the area. So that's one. To find another, I made my way over to the other side of the city in the eastern part of Vancouver, and I'm at a less picturesque spot. It's framed by industrial parks, shopping plazas, and commuter rail lines.
If you want to come with an adventure on me, we're going to kind of follow the path of the creek as it's buried under a pipe.
Okay.
Because we'll have to walk through some parking lots and things to find...
I'm up for an adventure.
Find the creek.
It's like an urban hunt or something.
Yeah, exactly. I think the vision here would be...
That's
right,
Amir Talagani. He's my guide and a senior engineer for flood and drainage planning at the City of Vancouver. With his day-glow vest and evident enthusiasm, his sense of adventure leads us to...
We're on Cornet Road, and this is the kind of last stretch of the creek before it keeps flowing east and crosses under the highway and goes past Vancouver into Burnaby on the other side. And from there, it goes all the way into Burnaby Lake. And from Burnaby Lake, it becomes the Burnett River and goes into the Fraser River. Water from here goes all the way to the ocean.
I'm sorry, it doesn't look terribly impressive. It's quite small.
I think it's much narrower than it would have been in the past. You know, it's kind of a surviving stream in Vancouver. Vancouver has very few urban streams, but it was a place, you know, before settlement, development of the city, that had over 50 wild streams in the city. This is one of the last ones left. And yeah, it's quite narrow here. In some other parts, it's a bit wider if we go stand over there.
I pick my way down the steep side of the stream to get close enough to hear the water flowing. On both banks, there are trees providing shade, even a few ducks.
Well, Still Creek is very special in Vancouver because it's one of the last salmon-bearing watercourses in the region. There's a few others.
But that name, Still Creek, it seems about right. There's not much happening in this Still Creek. Amir tells me to think again.
It's also, and this is near and dear to my heart, it's a very important natural drainage asset. It wasn't replaced with a pipe, but it's still functioning to provide drainage for this whole watershed and for the surrounding areas, and it helps manage flooding. It keeps, you know, there's lots of space in here for water. And on top of that, you know, it's a hugely important ecological and cultural asset to the community, and through our planning work, we have heard from the local First Nations that it is an important waterway as well. So it's a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
History does describe a waterway teeming with fish surrounded by rainforest and plants. That's before the city took shape with concrete and pipes and sewers that buried so many urban streams. But here, a few kilometers were more or less left alone. And so the efforts to uncover and care for more of Still Creek took hold.
Are you telling me not to get run over?
I have my high-vis vest here, so it's always challenging. So here's the creek.
This is the creek?
This is the creek.
Okay, Amir has now led me across the back of two buildings, through parking lots, and to a manhole that is pretty close to a four-lane roadway that's jammed with cars. But Amir insists, if I listen, the creek is there. So I bend over, poke my microphone through the grate, and I press record.
Yeah, we got some interesting looks. It's always funny when you're head down taking the audio from a sewer manhole and people are looking at you.
And yes, I agree. I looked odd.
I've been doing this for a long time. I have stuck my microphone in some very strange places over the years.
And always in pursuit of the story, I might add. Here the story is of a waterway that's ready to resurface and play its role in a changing climate.
I'm on a bit of a mission to tell people that this is an important, not even just local, a regional drainage asset. It helps take all of this water when it rains, and it rains a lot in Vancouver, all the way out to the ocean. So it's going to rain more as climate change continues. And our city's, you know, getting more and more developed. So we need to make room for water. And that's kind of the new refreshed vision we're bringing for Still Creek in our recent work, which is that we want to make room for water, and we want to show people that not only is it, ecological and cultural asset, it can also be a big part of us adapting to climate change and servicing growth in the city.
Amir also shows me other parts of the creek that are exposed but not rehabilitated. There are tangles of invasive weeds choking the banks, no trees, and it isn't as wide as he'd like to see it. The wider it is, the more rainfall it can handle. Amir thinks Vancouver can and will do this over time, as the city redevelops with climate in mind. It's not cheap, he says, but it's an investment in the future. And that's something he thinks about, especially because he has a young daughter.
I think her generation and kids nowadays, they're really going to be living with the future climate. I'd like to think that, you know, my daughter's going to hold me accountable as much as she can. And I'd like to have some things to point to say, hey, we were trying to make some things better and adapt to climate change in some ways. So.
Laura, I love how you can hear so much excitement in Amir's voice when he's talking. Vancouver really is ahead of Montreal and Toronto when it comes to daylighting.
It really is, Jayla. Vancouver, in fact, wants to daylight even more of Still Creek, and that will take decades of work. It would cost up to $200 million. I also mentioned the restoration work on Canyon Creek, and that's expected to start later this year. And there's the daylighting of another historic stream further east that's almost finished. It's expected to be unveiled later this spring. So, Jayla, you started me out on this journey. I want to thank you for that because I've really enjoyed it.
You are so welcome. Thank you, Laura.
Jayla Bernstein is a reporter with CBC's News Labs in Montreal. The documentary was produced with help from our colleagues at CBC's Audio Doc Unit. Emily Chung also contributed to the reporting. And if you want to learn more about Canada's lost rivers, I cannot say enough about Jayla's interactive article online. You got to go see it. It's really, really neat. It's on our website, cbc.ca/radio/whatonearth.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's catch you up on some other climate stories in the news this week. RBC executives faced a barrage of questions about the bank's climate and Indigenous rights track record at its annual general meeting in Toronto recently. Critics say RBC still isn't doing enough to tackle climate change as it continues to lend billions to the fossil fuel industry. Olaf Weber of the University of Waterloo's Climate Institute says Canada's big financial players are big supporters of oil and gas.
Canadian banks are relatively high compared to others. Canada has a high ratio of fossil fuels.
In fact, RBC was ranked as the world's largest funder of fossil fuels in a 2022 report. In response, the bank's top officers pointed to the plans to regularly disclose how much it invests in fossil fuels compared to clean energy projects. And that move came after pressure from large investors like pension funds. Some new vessels will be cruising through the Port of Vancouver this spring, and they'll be doing it very quietly. Two fully electric tugboats have been unveiled by one of the port's tug operators. The new boats are part of the company's efforts to address its carbon footprint and will reduce emissions by levels similar to getting 600 cars off the roads each year. The company says electric tugboats also help minimize underwater noise, which can harm sea life. A top European court has ruled the Swiss government violated its citizens' human rights by failing to take enough action against climate change. The decision comes from the European Court of Human Rights. A group of 2,000 senior women filed a lawsuit arguing Switzerland's failures put them at risk of dying during heat waves. The court listed the country's failure to meet its greenhouse gas emission reduction targets as part of the problem. Andrew Gage with West Coast Environmental Law expects the ruling will be cited in similar court challenges in Canada.
The courts, by and large, are accepting that climate change is a huge threat to Canadian society, as well as posing very real risks to individual Canadians and their health.
Still, there aren't any Canadian rulings linking government climate policy to rights violations. And for more climate stories, check out the What on Earth newsletter. You can subscribe to have it delivered to your inbox every week. Hey, have you noticed that we're now dropping two podcasts every week, every Wednesday, every Saturday? So just go and make sure you check your feed on Wednesday nights for a new episode that is jam-packed full of climate solutions, as always. And while you're there, leave us a review, because believe me, we read every one of them. Or you could share a favorite episode with a friend, because that really helps us out to spread the word. And that's a wrap for now. The show was put together by Andy Mullins, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.